hard to constrain. I'm glad to be here. It's really exciting. It's fun to meet parents and alums and particularly ex-students. And we'll be happy to know you don't have to take notes in the nice times, but you can hear me as an exam. Maybe some life exam, perhaps. I feel compelled to start out by saying I'm not really a sex difference researcher, per se. I'm really a health psychologist who has always been interested in the way that personality traits and interpersonal relationships, like marriage, kind of get under the skin, trying to understand. Oh, she said, okay. Trying to understand the impact of those. And the sex difference part, once you actually really investigate those, it becomes really clear that a lot of personality traits and things like marriage really impact men and women differently. So tonight I'm not remotely going to attempt to cover all of sex differences. That would be kind of silly. But I am going to attempt a parsimonious view, and in particular try to give you a couple key ways in which biological and social emotional ways in which gender impacts us. And the idea, of course, is to be able to teach you enough so that new findings that you hear or discussions, you can kind of understand those a bit. So I'm going to start by giving a flavor here to just sort of understanding all the group of things that really affect health. And this, of course, is morbidity and mortality. If you can't quite read that. Morbidity, if you may not know, is essentially talking about illness, right? Mortality is obviously death, not mortality. And traditionally we think about genetics and biology, right, having a lot to do with whether we get sick and whether we die. And of course, I have foreign antigens there, the idea that, infectious diseases obviously enter in. In the last couple decades, we've paid a lot more attention to health behaviors. And things like what you eat and how much you exercise, those key things really being important. Now, interestingly, when you look at a collection of health behaviors and genetics and foreign antigens, it actually doesn't do that great of a job of predicting what you die of and when you die. Take something like coronary disease, right, which is the leading cause of death for both men and women. And if you take the set of those, even adding in health behaviors, you only account for about, roughly 50% of the predictive value. So there's a lot more variability there, a lot more variance. And in the last, couple decades, we focused a lot more on positive emotions, personality traits, and of course relationships in terms of predicting health outcomes. So gender, of course, the focus of this talk really determines a lot of patterns of illness. So I have here mortality. Look at life expectancy. Of course, it differs by gender, also by race. If you go to the CDC website, which is sort of the best information out there, this is data actually from 2007, and they don't just parse it by gender; they parse it by race. But we can kind of look here at the combined, you can see the combined overall mortality rate. So our average life expectancy in the United States is there at 77.9. Females are on the upper end. So the W there is for white, the B is for black. That's just the way the CDC parses that. But you can see that females outlive males by a significant amount. In fact, when you do all the math and average those, it's a difference of 5.1 years in terms of mortality. So gender also, of course, affects what you get and when you get it, right? Disease onset. So these are the top 10 causes of death in the United States, just everybody combined. You can see heart disease up there at the top. Cancer followed second, and then stroke. When you add stroke and heart disease together, those are very similar risk factors, contribute to both of those, are really cardiovascular diseases, then you can see really that heart disease and stroke together have the lion's share, right? We're way over 30% when you combine those. And then, of course, let's see, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or lung diseases that are contributed to by smoking, predominantly, a behavior. Unintentional injuries, accidents, predominantly, actually, motor vehicle accidents, which have alcohol. So we also get some behavior in there as well. And then we go to some sugar, also known as diabetes, flu disease. The flu actually is sort of on the security thing. Actually, what I want to die of, generally, but I've lived long enough not to die of these other things. So this is one I hope we all need. And then, of course, kidney disease. Septicemia, by the way, is sort of blood infections, which is sort of the downside of going to the hospital and not quite recovering from whatever else you were there for. But when we parse this by gender, you begin to see some interesting patterns here. So we have heart disease up at the top for both. Men, a little bit more. Now, that might not look like much in terms of the percentage, but you have to think about every percentage is hundreds of thousands of people, right? This is data from 2006, which is the latest year that the CDC gives us real data, and I believe that there were a little over 2.5 million people who died in the U.S. that year, so you can sort of map those percentages. What's interesting is that reflection on this slide is, of course, men and women get heart disease at different rates, right? Men tend to get it earlier, show earlier morbidity illness, so signs of heart disease like high blood pressure, higher cholesterol, those sorts of things. Women tend to be pretty healthy up until menopause, and then when the helpful effects of estrogen tend to be much lessened, heart disease sort of rushes in. The number two cause there, both is cancer. You can see, of course, some different patterns of those. Next slide. This is actually lifetime risk of cancer diagnosis. The previous, of course, was causes of death, and there's differences because we're, of course, better at treating some things, right? There's certain types of cancers that are particularly. But you can look, certainly, at the individual, but I'll draw your attention down here to the bottom rates, where we can see that men, the lifetime risk, and this is a percentage, the lifetime risk of getting cancer if you're male is about 45%. Lifetime risk of females is 38%. Some gender divides, and we're going to refer back to this. Let's see, what else do we see here? For men, we see accidents, right here, are the cause, and this is, of course, motor vehicle accidents, blood alcohol, emotional involved. Women, they're slower, right, which is also reflective of usually alcohol patterns. Stroke kind of moves in here. What else do I want to call attention to? Alzheimer's is interesting. That's much more predominant for women. And of course, Alzheimer's is age related. So part of that is that women are more likely to have Alzheimer's because they're living longer, right? Many men are often just dying a little bit earlier, so they're not advancing. But obviously, you know, there's different patterns. And I guess part of the question we'll get to is why. So that's mortality, right? And again, I'm just painting this in very broad strokes to try to cover. Morbidity, of course, illness. We can look at different rates of things like depression and anxiety, right? These that definitely take value away from the life that we live. Depression and anxiety are much more likely to be diagnosed in women. In contrast, with substance use, which is much more likely to be diagnosed in men. Also, there's a lot of physiological disease processes that differ across gender. So weight distribution patterns and sort of the sequelae that come from that. So the effects of diabetes can be a little bit different across gender, depending on right where you're carrying weight. We'll get back to this issue. Autoimmune conditions as well. Women are much, much more likely to be diagnosed with autoimmune conditions like MS, type 1 diabetes. There's a ton of diseases out there, some of the newer diseases, things like lupus, for instance, that we're realizing are really autoimmune diseases. Okay, so in order to do this, I really have to sort of bring up the issue of stress physiology, and hopefully the fight or flight idea is familiar to most of you. Classic fight or flight response is, of course, you're walking in the woods, right, and suddenly a bear appears out of nowhere and growls, right? And immediately, right, so the theory goes, you want to be able to either run, right, away from the bear, or stand and protect yourself in some way, right? And so to do that, by the way, running away from the bear is not usually that's the bird. To do that, the body harnesses a whole cascade of physiological responses that's going to allow you really to get energy and oxygen to your muscles so you can move more effectively. So, in particular, we see acceleration of heartbeats. Acceleration of heartbeat, your lungs get dilated a little bit so that blood that goes through your oxygen more easily. It shuts down things like digestion, which you don't really need, and it does, you know, a number of things. So all over, you get increases in heart rate, you get blood pressure, changes in particular your vasculature all narrows so that blood can really get through and the system into muscles really quickly. So you don't need things like urine, unfortunately, to get rid of any stressed people and that's on its own. So that's the sympathetic response, right? Our classic stress response. On the other side of that is kind of returning to the parasympathetic. We often call it rest and digest. Another way to think about this is sort of, this is the gas pedal and this is the brake pedal, our biological systems. So the fight or flight response is really well designed to help us deal with immediate physical stressors, right? Really well designed. Unfortunately, this same fight or flight response goes off when we're, let's say, in traffic and kind of in a hurry and some jerk cuts us off, right? We can't do anything with all the energy that has just been opened up and dumped into our bloodstream and our heart, you know, blood that's running everywhere, but nevertheless, we feel the effects of stress, right? And, you know, same with being in the grocery line or worrying about your taxes, right? All of those things, right, our human brain gives us all sorts of things to worry about in the future. That's one of the great things about humans. We can worry about not just what's happening in front of us, but all those things in the future. So we tend to have lots of opportunities for this fight or flight response. And unfortunately, with only tiny bits of variation, this is what happens to our body when stress comes from, right? We have this great stress, but we have or we have this great physiological response, we don't have that for it. So it does some damage, right? And actually, you know, the story of sort of wears and tears on the body, it's really predominantly a stress-mediated story. So we can think about whatever the stressful thought is, right? Whatever the stressful thought is a start. And that's going to start the sympathetic nervous system response, being there for fight or flight. And it talks a little bit about cardiovascular, right? We have this increasing heart rate, blood pressure. And that, of course, is going to put some wear and tear on the body. We also have, pretty much simultaneously, a tiny bit lagging behind the cardiovascular response as well. But we have an endocrine system response, our hypothalamic pituitary adrenal gland. Our adrenal gland pumps out tons of stress hormones. And the one that's important here probably is cortisol, mostly we need to think about. So we have an increase in cortisol. Now, one of the important things that cortisol does, and how it really is functional in the stress response, cortisol is designed to take fat cells and promote those opening up and the energy that's being stored in fat cells to be dumped into the bloodstream. Okay? Which is good. You need energy, again, to run away from here. Now, unfortunately, while that's a kind of helpful side, in emergencies, one of the other things that cortisol does is it goes over and it affects the immune system. In a particular, what it does is it, you know, your immune system has different cells that are sort of constantly being renewed, and you know, you kind of have some cells around that are kind of old and sluggish, right? So cortisol sort of trims the fat from those, right? It selectively kills off some of the old and sluggish, right, immune system cells. But of course, when you have a lot of that trimming, right, if you have a big enough stress response or frequent stressors that continue on, what you see is actually immune system downregulation. You see a reduction in immune capabilities. So, what happens? I've mapped on now a lot of the diseases that we saw in those earlier slides. What happens when we do this repeatedly, right? When we have these continual stress responses, our cardiovascular stuff goes up. What happens, of course, when we increase heart rate and blood pressure and we have blood that's rushing constantly, right, repeatedly through our system, is it slams against your arterial walls, right? It slams against the walls of your arteries and capillaries, and it causes little tiny tears, right? They actually, the cell walls actually kind of tear and open up. That, of course, isn't good. And if there's circulating stuff in the blood, right, that high fat, and you just add, or maybe a little carcinogenic stuff from cigarettes, all that, whatever, it comes and kind of fills in those gaps and actually begins to migrate under the walls of your cell walls. And you get a healing response as well. So your immune system actually comes and kind of seals that over, and you get some scar tissue. Well, if this happens over and over and over again, right, what you have is lining the walls of your arteries is what we call atherosclerosis, right? It's this plaque. It actually looks like gruel. You take like oatmeal and you boil it for a really long time, and you let it sit, that's kind of what it looks like. So that, of course, is not too good. And we see heart disease and stroke. And stroke, by the way, heart disease, usually, we think about this kind of heart attack, is when one of those atherosclerotic plaques break off, top somewhere in the heart, and stop blood flow. So the heart doesn't harm, but muscle does. Stroke is simply when that process happens. Now, if, of course, like I have respect to cortisol here, and all of your fat cells are opening up and dumping energy into the bloodstream, that's great for the bloodstream, but your fat cells are hungry, right? They've just been emptied. And of course, fat cells, turns out, are what regulate our hunger mechanisms. This is called leptin, actually, which won't go into that. It's a whole other talk. But the fat cells are hungry, and so they send messages to the brain, which causes you to go forage for food, right? So despite the fact that you have plenty of energy that's circulating in your body, you're down in the pantry wondering where the chocolate is, right? That's a human form of foraging for food. In any case, what that does is it increases heart rate, and we progress to things like obesity and, of course, conditions like high blood sugar, sharp blood sugars, that are now, if you think about translating this into the immune system, when you really suppress the immune system, one of the important jobs of the immune system isn't just to catch, you know, the flu virus that comes in, but one of the other important things it does is all the time scan the body and find those potentially mutant cells that might turn into cancer, and it moves through the body. It says, okay, you're looking weird, you don't look like a self cell anymore, I'm gonna take care of you. Well, when the immune system is impaired, it is more likely that it misses some of those. So we see a progression to cancer. And then, unless you have neurotoxicity there, because cortisol is not good for brain cells, in particular, it tends to really have a strong effect on brain cells in the hippocampus, which is important for memory formation and regulation. So we see things like progression to Alzheimer's or just memory problems in general, or those connections with stress-related memory impairment. It also tends to alter the set of neurons in our dopamine system, our sort of pleasure sensing system, and alters them in such a way that they become less sensitive, actually, to things like serotonin, which is important in regulation, so in progression, and also then perceiving the pleasure. So we see some links even to some of those sort of morbidity discussions. Now, after your negative coping, we think about all this stress, right? What you do with those sort of negative feelings, you see some smoking. Can you see really sort of painted, right, ways in which all this stuff, all the stress connections and what's happening in the body is really connected to our brain causing symptoms? Okay, so this makes a lot of sense, right, if we really hang our hat on this fight-or-flight mechanism. But let me ask you this. How, think back, right, to foraging for food, right, or let's say you're, you know, and again, many, many generations back, we think about ancestors being, you know, sort of in a village and a neighboring warring clan comes into town, right? You can think about either of those, whatever, pick your scenario. You could run or fight, and that would make a lot of sense if you're male, right? But what happens if you're carrying an infant? What happens if you have an infant here? You know, you're out gathering berries and you're sort of an infant slung on your back. Does running seem like a good idea? No. Anyone tried to run with an infant? What about fighting? Can you put your input down and like start fighting? No, it doesn't. None of that makes any sense, right? So this is noted, right? And some people, particularly a psychologist at UCLA, a woman named Shelley Taylor, came up and kind of looked at all of this and looked at all this really interesting animal data and some human data and really came up with this theory that women don't have fight or flight. They have what she deemed tend and befriend. That when faced with a stressor, what women tend to do, and this fits actually sort of observational data as well, what women tend to do is they tend to quiet, right? And particularly tend to offspring. And think about, right, if you're trying to hide in the bushes, you want to be able to quiet that infant down, right, so the mooring clan or the bear doesn't see you. Or it's a safety in numbers, right? Go stand with everybody else. At least maybe someone else will get into it. But that idea that seeking affiliation with others, forming those bonds and relationships, and having a good relationship with your infants enough where you're protective and can kind of quiet and soothe is a pattern that would actually fit and promote longevity, right? Offspring living. So this tended friend, right, is really, and this is an idea that came about, I guess, about 10 years or so. And it's one of those huge revolutionary ideas, particularly in health psychology, but is spanning into other areas of psychology. And that idea that tend and befriend is a much more predominant and, of course, adaptive stress response in women. Now, interestingly, if we think about kind of a biological promoter of this, the best candidate is a hormone called oxytocin. Now, some of you may have heard, anyone heard of oxytocin? We talk about oxytocin as the love hormone. We talk about it as the cuddle hormone. Oxytocin is actually the hormone that's released in women who are about ready to give birth. It increases contractions, right? It brings on contractions. In fact, Pitocin, right, which they give you if you're way overdue and they need to lose labor, is an artificial version of oxytocin. Okay? So it facilitates birth. It facilitates, in nursing mothers, milk letdown, so facilitating feeding. But it also facilitates this bonding, right? We have tons, again, originally tons of animal data, now some really good human data, so showing that oxytocin really facilitates this bond. Okay. Now, the other interesting thing, of course, is oxytocin, we now know, increases parasympathetic response, remember a great cuddle or a rest and digest. And in particular, in that frame, it lowers our blood pressure and heart rate, right? So women are a little more likely to have oxytocin on board, to really think about sort of that evolutionarily being more likely in women. So we're going to have to at least predict, right, a lower blood pressure and heart rate mechanism. It's also true that oxytocin lowers the amount of cortisol that's released, right? So roughly in half or sometimes way less than half. It also changes pain sensitivity, which is kind of helpful when you're not ready to go. But in any case, a whole nice set of things. It also turns out to really cause imprint behaviors. So when we can actually give people oxytocin, men and women, and what we find is that they tend to affiliate. Right? When you give them oxytocin and you give them a choice, you can go. There's a stressor ahead, and you go wait with some people, or you go hang out by yourself and kind of prepare. People with high levels of oxytocin go choose to wait with other people, seek out affiliation. And that, of course, is different than aggression or running. Now, it's also important to know that women don't tend to have as much, thinking about this in a gender kind of way, the hormones that might promote a more aggressive response, which is testosterone. Women have a little bit of it. Not nearly the same level, and actually testosterone in women does tend to promote the same sort of aggressive response, unless it seems sort of actually protective. So here's the other thing. In times of stress, oxytocin is actually released in both men and women. So it's actually, I talked about cortisol being released as part of the endocrine response. Oxytocin also gets released at the same time. But oxytocin is potentiated by the presence of estrogen. So it becomes much more effective, much stronger response in terms of altering the physiology. It's also important to note that technique and confronting this activity causes more oxytocin release. So it's nice sort of feedback with, right? Tendon befriending and oxytocin, you have more oxytocin, you do more tendon befriending, right? So it's this sort of cycle that women in particular can get in, but men can get in as well. So if we think about then what the effect of that would be on women, right? And we're really talking about premenopausal women, because if we have this effect of estrogen, that's really, right? We have the premenopausal women. So in this case, right, there's stressful thought, right, sympathetic nervous system response, it changes that to tell you we're not going to left by the idea is here, thoughts are supposed to indicate that this is a tumor, right? So less in response because we have oxytocin and attention by this estrogen on board. And so what we see is, right, we predict a little less cardiovascular response, right? Not as strong of a heart rate and emotional response, which is going to reduce the likelihood and slow the progression anyway of heart disease and stroke, and that's exactly what we see. In terms of endocrine and how to deal with the immune system first, when you really, really when you really do a lot of sharpening, right? When you have a strong cortisol response, you're going to keep sharpening and sharpening and sharpening and sharpening and sharpening your immune system to the point where it's downregulated. But when you just do a little bit of sharpening, it actually does what nature intended, which is to make the immune system stronger. Problem is, when you make the immune system stronger, it begins to make some mistakes, right? Instead of going, oh, that's a self-cell and making it accurate, it begins to sort of be overzealous. And so it sees self cells as foreign antigens. And that's the whole underlying basis of autoimmune disorders. Right? So again, all this goes to sleep as antigens. And that again is exactly what we see. That women actually have an enhanced immunity, which is going to lower their risk of cancer to die, and it's going to raise their risk of autoimmune diseases. Now, of course, we could also predict here that this might be stretching a bit, I'll talk with my hands, right? Okay, but I start stretching a bit. But we could sort of say, well, if there's a lessened response, then women at least aren't sort of overwhelmed by negative emotions to the point where they really have to sort of melt them out or more comfortable with them. I don't know. I haven't seen a sort of try to go that way, but I think it was fine. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the obesity and eating stuff here, because the important part here is to probably think about another important dimension of gender, and that is where men and women tend to hold their fat cells. And here's my apple shape, right? Which tends to be more common in men, and the pear shape, right, which tends to be more common in women. So holding fat cells down around the hip area versus central, right? And it's a pretty well-established gender difference, right? All of you, by the way, we're talking, there's always shade of gray, right? Everything we're talking about. But in general, we tend to see this is a pretty solid fat distribution. Now, if you think about the action of cortisol, so fat cells are wherever they are. Cortisol comes and it opens up those fat cells, right? And it dumps energy into the blood when stressed. And so you're going to have energy sort of circulating around wherever those fat cells are. Now, eventually, that extra energy has to be put back into a fat cell, right, somewhere. So if you have fat cells here and energy gets opened up and it kind of circulates, it begins to circulate and sort of redistribute in around, right, the central organs. It doesn't turn out to travel that far. And so what you get is you get fat that gets sort of embedded, rather than being subcutaneous, where fat starts out, it starts getting embedded into internal organs. And that's what happens here, usually much more likely to men. If you have your fat cells down here, right, then fat sort of, you know, it sort of gets redistributed, it goes in and out, but it stays down here, which turns out to be a healthier option. So when you look at the health risks that are associated with being apple-shaped, or pear-shaped, it's all on the opposite. So, insulin resistance, high insulin levels, high cholesterol, low amounts of HDL, which are good cholesterol, diabetes, coronary disease, heart disease, stroke, they're all listed here on the apple sheet. Now, many people will note that postmenopausally, wherever women have had fat that is distributed more down the thighs, postmenopausally, tends to be distributed more evenly throughout the body. So what we've begun to think is there's something about estrogen too, which may be altering the way that fat cells migrate. That's something that no one's quite figured out yet. But it certainly is of note, again, in other studies. Okay, I'm going to move on to the other side. So it's sort of this clear sort of biological, right? So some fat distribution, but particularly this idea of oxytocin really short-circuiting the stress response and that having a big impact on those major diseases. So in thinking about social emotional mechanisms, and this is where most of my research is kind of I'll start with morbidity because it's kind of easier, and that is, you know, this idea that gender roles really support women's ability to say that they're anxious and depressed, like that's sort of socially more acceptable for women. Men are more likely to cover that negative emotion with substance use or with anger, right? And of course, we see again those divides in terms of disease. And that may, of course, have something to do with the intensity that they feel. Men being, again, if they have a stronger physiological response in terms of fight or flight, they may actually feel a little overwhelmed by the negative emotions that are there. So, certainly in terms of morbidity, that's another important thing I want to say, though, just as kind of two things. That whole stress cascade, we basically just said started with a stressful thought. And of course, the stressful thoughts, of course, can come from social and emotional. So those are really vast. And depending on, you know, where, you know, social settings and emotional, whether it's job or relationship or all those, tons of stressors can come. This is a huge area. The other thing that I want to really point out is that social support, or the converse of that, not being socially isolated, so low social isolation, is very health protective. We know some tons of epidemiological studies from lab studies as well. And this social support can, by the way, come from a variety of places. My favorite are the studies that actually look at, like, just having your dog with you. You know, for people are great, but even having your dog with you tends to lower your blood pressure and reduce your stress. Anyway, but important to know that social support is good. Now, we think about gender here, social roles, and obviously oxytocin. If oxytocin is kind of, it has a stronger effect, and oxytocin is priming women in particular to go seek out social support in these stressors, we're going to see social support really as a really important, effective thing in women, or maybe not so much naturally unless they. Okay. So, the last section I want to really focus on here is intimate relationships. And in particular, thinking about the primary important relationships in our lives. And those, of course, are ones that are lifelong. And in terms of study, particularly if we want to study sex differences, the easiest thing, of course, is to study marriage. And by the way, most of the researchers have actually studied marriage. Certainly, looked at domestic partners. There have been some interesting studies, but only very few of them, unfortunately, looking, and we can't do sex differences, but looking at, you know, male-male partnerships and female-female partnerships. And there's some interesting cross-things there, but I'm going to focus mostly on marriage here, because that's where the vast majority of the research is. Marriage, right, obviously a central role for many people. And it's interesting when we look at the effect of marriage on health, right? And I'm particularly talking about health. I'm not talking about how to enjoy marriage. Not health. What we find is that marriage is a lot, it offers a lot more protection to men than it does to women. And in particular, the reduction in mortality for being married for men is about 250%, right? So versus, in comparison with an unmarried man, a married man, right, gets a 250% reduction in mortality, okay? Well, married men can thank your wives. For women, it helps, but it's only about a 50% reduction. So the question is, why is that? And there are a couple different hypotheses, all of which have received some evidence, but it's very general here. There's first of all the behavioral route, and it turns out, of course, that women are more likely to be the agents of change, right? So women are more likely to say, gosh, you need some exercise, and you need some vitamins, and you need some vegetables, and you need some stress management. men tend to follow their wives' advice, not so much the other way around. So, hence, right, women aren't getting as much out of it, but men are getting a lot because they're following their wives' advice. So there's that. There's also, as I call the eggs, where you put your eggs, right? Men tend to put all of their eggs, right, emotionally, socially, in the wife basket, right? Men tend to report that their primary sources of social support come from their wives, and they're less likely, they may have friends, but they're less likely to sort of seek support and counsel and et cetera, rely on friendships. So marriage is really important for men. For women, right, I have this one basket versus several baskets and a child as well. Looking there, women tend to have more sources, diverse sources of social support. So if they're not able to get social support from their husband, it's sort of not as important, right, in that they have other sources. Again, we're talking about so then the last, and this again is where I've done most of my research, is actually looking at the downside of marriage, the negative effects that might come from an acrimonious relationship. So, and it turns out, if we look at marital conflict, right, that it's more toxic for women than it is for men. And this kind of makes sense if we think about, at least socially, women tend to be socialized to be, as we refer to it, the kinship leaders, right? This idea that sort of responsible for maintaining relationships, and if marriage isn't going well, it's kind of your fault, right? This sets a role that women tend to take on that than men don't, but again, more likely to be a female trait. So when we take couples and put them in the laboratory, right, and we hook them up, right, and we have a couple of great studies doing this, we hook them up to physiological recording devices, and then we argue, which is what we see is that women are much more likely to have a high blood pressure. They're more responsive, like greater increases in blood pressure than men. And this actually, by the way, is irrespective of the behavioral differences. So they both would be arguing like that. You know, that doesn't matter, but it's the women who show the effect physiologically. It's also true that in that case, women are very responsive to the interpersonal climate in the marriage. So if you have a high hostile husband, and hostility, by the way, is one of those personality differences, it's like it would be bad for purposes. But if you have a high hostile husband, women are really affected by their husband's hostility, where that's not true the other way around. You have a high hostile wife, and we don't see the effects on the men's physiology. And so so another aspect here, right, if we propose that oxytocin is really helpful, and I guess when I talked about oxytocin, I didn't talk as much about this, but oxytocin is increased particularly by skin-to-skin contact. And an easy way to think of it is, for those of you who had children, you think about that sort of moment where you take your infant and you put them right here, right? Birth is common. When that happens, we actually see an oxytocin release. So the technical name for that is ventral stroking, right? So we have this chest-to-chest sort of contact, the kind that you might get in a hug, right, which we hope would be in marriage. Also from physical forms of intimacy, we see some oxytocin. So if we have a bad or conflictual marriage, I should say, this is alienation from those sources of oxytocin. So, and again, since oxytocin really is showing up as more effective in women, that's going to be a hit more for her physiology. And then the last thing here on this list is, and this is something that's a little bit newer, I actually have a recent study out, which if you want later I can talk about, like, spread yourself, but really looking at women's and men's, but attempts at self-regulation, right, in the context of an argument. And in the context of an argument, self-regulation is really trying to put the brakes on the escalation of the argument. It is sort of damping down one's own negative feelings, again, in the service of not letting things get behaviorally out of control. And we note that women do a lot more self-regulation in the context of conflictual interactions than men do. And when they do it, when there's this sort of effortful self-regulation, it does something really negative, and that is it lowers parasympathetic responding. So again, remember, parasympathetic is the good stuff, that's the sort of calm. So despite the fact that women are trying to be calm in the context of a discussion and not let it escalate, we see this, what we call called parasympathetic withdrawal. Now that's puts differential loads on the heart, which is not really we're only beginning to understand this because this is sort of, we spent a lot of time research-wise on the sympathetic end, we're only beginning to sort of go, oh, well, wait a minute, look, if we have lowered parasympathetic, that's a bad thing too. So anyway, so suffice it to say that again, that is happening more in women than in men. Even if we see the behavioral self-regulation, you don't see the physiological effect. And that is, we kind of think about that self-regulation idea, we can sort of retain it a little bit, we move it into something more like a personality kind of variable. Get to this thing, which is a favorite of mine, called unmitigated communion. And unmitigated communion, communion is sort of this focus on others, right, versus agentic, which is sort of self-strength. Communion is communal strength, focusing on the needs of others. And when you get at a really extreme, right, you get a lot of communion that is not mitigated or softened in any way by agency, you get somebody who spends a lot of time focusing on the needs of others, and it really ends up being to the detriment of the self. Now, I'll admit that I was always interested in this because it sort of drives my mother, right? But anyway, we wonder about the health consequences of this. And it just so happens, of course, that unmitigated communion is much more likely to be present in women than it is in men. We certainly see it in men. In fact, interestingly, in the studies that I've done at UPS, we tend to have fairly communal men. I know that that's sort of a more evolved kind of setting. So I actually do have, in some of my research samples, some high unmitigated communion men, but traditionally it's more of a feminine kind of trait. If, of course, I'm talking about it because it's related to poor health outcome, it's related to psychological morbidity, right, in terms of progression to anxiety and depression and increased feelings of stress. And also there's some behavioral effects, right? So some studies looking, not that I did, but some studies looking at people who are diabetic and who have high identity community, they don't take care of themselves, right? They don't eat right and they don't spend so much time focused on other people. I have a college from there, a study that I did when I first got to UPS that looked at unmitigated communion as a variable in just like freshmen and sophomores as they came in. And then I measured lots of health outcomes about 4 months later and found that high unmitigated communion predicted progression to anxiety and depression and actually more foods and illnesses, more sort of days and trips to the hospital. You know, really thinking about ways in which our thoughts and emotions and behaviors really get invisible. And I'm currently in the middle of analyzing data that does interactions with some of the other stuff in dating couples and have beginning to see signs that unmitigated communion massively is also important. Okay, my last slide. Obviously, this has implications for both genders, right? We can think about, well, gosh, oxytocin is good for men. It's good for women, but really we have to think, well, gosh, it's good for men too, right? It has these same effects on physiology. What does that mean? Obviously, all of this starts with good stress management. If we don't have stressful thoughts, then we can find ways and outlets for those stressful thoughts, and we don't turn on the sympathetic response in the first place. So this is certainly an endorsement for finding good outlets for stress. Also, engaging activities that are kind of promote oxytocin release, so spending time with others, having good primary relationships, hugging, right? All of those things are going to increase oxytocin release, which again is beneficial in both men and women. Having some control over some of those social, emotional, relational stressors, and particularly if there is stress in prior relationships like marriage, that really active and early intervention is not just feels better in terms of dynamics there, but is actually helpful. And of course, I say that as a psychologist. And then, of course, obviously promoting social roles that are going to facilitate, right, some of those social and emotional needs. What part? Did I scare you enough? You won't have any questions.
It's so, like, with the, when you're talking about when you're in the middle of an argument, self-regulate. Mm-hmm. That's like stuffing your emotions. Like, I guess, like, how would you operationalize that? That's what we're like. How would I know if I'm in the middle of an argument know that yet, so that you can't. If I can deal with oh, that feeling no. of sort of stuff.
Okay, maybe I'll get to it, because I think I need it. It is quite stuffy. It is self-monitoring enough where you think, oh gosh, I could go after that, but I'm not going to.
Right.
Oh, it is sort of actively deciding
whether or not you're going to talk about those.
Right, certain things, or the way that you phrase things, or monitoring your voice, or those sorts of things, where you're really trying your best to keep things under control. And there's an upside to that, because then arguments don't escalate, which is obviously bad in itself. But again, what's happening physiologically is not good. And ultimately, the concern, of course, behaviorally, is if you're really over self-regulating, then you're not really voicing concerns or sort of getting to the kinds of things that might actually help resolve the situation.
Learning how to absolutely monitor your tone
And that actually can include, by the way, in terms of intervention, being able to say, okay, I have some feelings about this, but I don't know that this is the best time. So rather than saying, oh no, I'm fine, or that's really okay, being able to step aside and say, let's talk about this and move on a little bit calmer.
All the police on us. Blinks her eyes.
Certainly, she sounds stressed. She's sad. Yeah. Well, perhaps, yeah, there's a whole range probably of interventions, but, you know, helping them feel heard without being drowned sounds like would be helpful. Yeah, she's probably, if she's that stressed, she's more likely to be progressing to some more acute events. Other questions? Yeah. Well, exercise is always good. Exercise is amazing, and in that form, it really doesn't matter to some extent what exercise you do. There are people who, you know, I'm a runner, that's how I do exercise. Other people choose to do yoga or play basketball. I mean, there's different benefits to all of them. Ideally, I mean, the nice thing about exercise is you're both getting some kind of cardiovascular and weight management stuff, but you're also getting some sort of break from rumination. And really, when we think about stress management, the important part is to take a break from whatever kind of stressors and worries are. So if exercise still takes that, then that is a great stress management. Certainly, you know, in the last decade or so, Americans and sort of the medical establishment have been much more into things like meditation and those sorts of stuff. They were totally playing catch up with sort of Eastern philosophy that have been doing that for years and have much better, frankly, profiles and things like that. But I think the key is anything that promotes that and is accessible for people. So for some people, meditation is the answer and they get a lot out of that. For other people, that's not active enough in some form of yoga or whatever. What's interesting about the greater practice of that isn't just the sort of 10 or 15 or 20 minutes or however long you do it, but essentially the muscle that gets exercised when you learn to take a break from it, when you learn to sort of let things go. And what's nice is that the more you exercise that and sort of develop that as a skill set, then when in times of stress, you're more likely to go, okay, just break here, which is gonna, again, short circuit that whole response. So it's not just the activity of the time doing it, but it's the sort of practice and having that in your tool so that when you need it, you can pull it out. So yeah, it's certainly things like meditation, again, anything that kind of allows that and can be tailored for people is what's going on. Any other questions?
Thanks so much, Jill. Thank you for building our knowledge base about stress management. You know, I have to admit, I am feeling a little stressed after that talk. As I did last night, I'm feeling particularly apple-shaped at this moment. But I'm also feeling very, very, very happy that I got that, because it's gonna do me well. Yeah, Mary's not quite as happy as I am, but we'll hug later and we'll all feel a lot better. Thank you all for spending this time with us tonight. We have some more things for you, as I mentioned earlier. Make sure you get a chance to do the virtual tour. It doesn't take long, and engage with Bob down at the TV monitor toward the front of the building before you leave. I think you'll be excited about what you see there. Also, we have some more refreshments for you before you leave. As you drive carefully. However, we want to make sure that that's the case. Also, some things to remind you of your evening tonight, some sweets and little trinkets about Puget Sound. Please take some of those as well. And as you go, I hope you'll also be thinking about how you can help us feel remembered. The campaign is meant to be a campaign to engage us all, to recruit us all in ways that are meaningful to you. Whether it's contributing to the campaign financially, contributing as a volunteer, getting engaged with your local club here in Chicago, being part of the Alumni Council, the Parents Council, whatever it is, we hope that you will find a way to be part of what we think is a bright and very promising future for the University of Puget Sound. And I also want to say thank you to everyone also for making us feel so welcome. It's been a while since we've been back here in Chicago, a little while. Last time we talked about the recession, this time about morbidity and so on. We're going to do something, but don't you feel good about it, though? I mean, I feel a lot better about my own morbidity tonight. But everywhere we've gone tonight, not just here among you, but even back at the hotel, people are saying, isn't it great that the president came back to Chicago? You know, the guy at the door as we were leaving. And I just want to say thank you. So, listen, I hope you have a great night tonight. Stay away from Navy Pier. There's a lot of traffic down there. But we thank you for being with us at the University of Puget Sound's Chicago Club, and we'll see you next time. Take care. Great night. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.